Well, I just come up with a title in the last minute, Like the Moon Released from a Cloud, which is one of the lines in the verses. Okay. A Cooper thought this idea of, he chose Angulimala and the encounter with Angulimala, but then his partner is having an operation, so he couldn't come. And I just couldn't resist having a go at it. I thought, oh, Angulimala. I always talk about Angulimala on the night of our beginner's course at the Glasgow Buddhist Centre, when we're describing the qualities of the Buddha. So there's the Kesha Gotami story, there's the Angulimala story, there's the story of the Buddha rescuing the dung collector. Do you know the story? From the back of the houses, the untouchable. And it just gives a spectrum of the Buddha's response to different people. And the story of Angulimala is so good. Everyone knows it. A Cooper would have been very interesting because he works with prison chaplaincy. He works with people in prison as part of the Pan-Buddhists, the different Buddhist organisations in Britain, coming together and running the Angulimala organisation or foundation or a name such as that. And it's about prisoners and for whatever misdeed being turned to the Dharma, being freed through the Dharma. I was taken to the story of the sutta itself as a real simple elegance, a real clarity to it. So I'll start with this. This is how it starts. I have heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying near Savati at Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. And at that time, in King Pasenadi's realm, there was a bandit named Angulimala, brutal, bloody-handed, devoted to killing and slaying, showing no mercy to living beings. He turned villages into non-villages, towns into non-towns, settled countryside into unsettled countryside. Having repeatedly killed human beings, he wore a garland made of fingers. A garland is a mala, fingers is anguli. So he wore his very name is this garland of fingers. Then the Blessed One, early in the morning, having put on his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, went to Savati for alms. Having wandered for alms in Savati, and returning from his alms round after his meal, set his lodging in order. Carrying his robes and bowl, he went along the road to where Angulimala was staying. It's really elegant, really simple. It's cool, is a contemporary word. You know, just very quietly, the Buddha's doing his normal morning practices, getting his breakfast, setting his house, his little lodging, his little hut, his little chamber pot, I presume, whatever that is in Pali. Everything's ready and tidied, and then off he goes. It's like the start of it's good movie material. I believe there's an Indian movie. Looking through, trawling through all the images, the one I found one for the booklet, but there's one where there's a very gruesome looking character, you know, the hair stuck out, and there's probably a big Indian movie which is built around this story. But this is the start. It reminds me of Yul Brynner in The Magnificent Seven, the start of that with the scene with the funeral. There's a coffin and he's got to get the coffin. He takes on the job of taking the coffin up the hill. Or the original, isn't it? Kurosawa's Seven Samurai, where it's very spacious, very simple and quite dramatic. So this is the scene set. The Buddha's just quietly setting out, heading to the forest. He walks along the road and passers-by say, don't go in there, don't go that way. That's where Angulimala comes. And the phrase comes, he clears out whole villages, he clears out whole towns, he's a bloody-handed. He ignores, quietly walks on. He's warned again. He keeps on walking. This elegant simplicity. The Buddha's heading along the dusty path, heading to this big dark forest. So who's this Angulimala? Why is he living in a forest, killing people and collecting fingers? The sutta itself is very simple. It doesn't explain why. He just is there and the Buddha sorts it out. There are scholars' theories. I was trying to find these. I couldn't locate them, but I'd heard rumours. Angulimala is an example of an early Indian religion that carried right on. Even today, you have human sacrifice happening occasionally in India. You've got the famous tuggies. If you've seen the Indiana Jones movie, you know, the Temple of Doom, there's a theory that Angulimala is a one-man Temple of Doom. These tuggies would live out in the wilds. They would have a whole family community, and their main job was catching people, sacrificing them to Kali, and collecting, robbing them. And that was just a traditional way of life for the family. And I think the British cleared them out, and they gave them jobs as weavers and settled them. And you still get these tuggy castes who weave rather than collecting fingers. There's a bigger story in the Pali commentaries. There's the suttas, and then there's lots of stuff that rolls along with the Pali tradition, with the Pali texts. And there's great stuff in there. It's like pantomime. It's an equivalent in German, so over-the-top Christmas performances where, look out behind you. Oh, no, it isn't. Oh, yes, it is. There's stock bad people, and there's stock good people, and there's usually a man dressed up as a woman and a woman dressed up as a man. All these, and these stories are full of characters like that and stories like that. Helmut Hecker has written up the stories together in originally in a German Buddhist magazine. Is it Vassal and Vandal? An old Buddhist magazine. It's in English on Access to Insight under the name of A Murderer's Road to Sainthood. And he's brought together all the commentarial stories and the sutta, and he's got a rip-roaring yarn in there. In the commentaries, Angulimala was born under a bad sign, as the blues song goes, in the constellation of the robber, and the astrologers at his birth look at it and go, this is going to be a bad life, he's going to rob. And the father thinks, discusses it with the king, will we kill the child to stop this happening? And then decides just to try to change this. He calls him ahimsaka, non-violence. He sends him off to college. He goes to learn all sorts of skills. Some stories or elaborations say medical college. He's a very good pupil. He studies hard. He's respectful. He's hard working. And the teacher starts to really respect him and care for him and treats him like a son. Takes him into his house. He eats with the family. But all his classmates get jealous and they want to turn the scholar, the teacher, against his new pet. His new teacher's pet, his favourite. And so the teacher eventually starts to believe the repeated rumours, the repeated doubts, and he thinks, I must get rid of this person. He's going to take over my job, he's going to throw me out, he's going to do me in. How will I do it? He looks so strong, he's so young, he's very fit. I won't be able to kill him myself. Of course, he's a scholar, so he thinks his way out of it. And he says, you must bring me 1,000 little fingers from human right hands in order for me to empower you with the final qualifications. For your teachings to be effective, you must follow these orders and bring me these fingers. And I presume he's still called Ahimsaka. This name isn't going to last for long. He says, okay, and off he goes to do his task. He gets 5 kinds of weapons in the story, different kinds of sharp, jaggy things. I suppose an alternative story for this talk could be encounters with a big, sharp knife. He also appears in the Jataka stories, in the collection of, also accompanying stories that follow the suttas of the past lives of the Buddha. The Buddha tells a story. It's of an exemplary leading animal that rescues his tribe, or a human that has an adventure and through intelligence or kindness or fortitude or loyalty wins out. And there's 500 or 600 of these. And Angulimala appears in several of them. At the end of each story, the Buddha says, and at that time, you were so-and-so, and you were so-and-so. And Angulimala always gets the bad guy. He always gets the big ogre or the yaka that Vedanya was talking about, these forest nature forces who have a fondness for eating human beings. And of course in the story, the Buddha to be is the hero, and through either honesty or guile or cunning or exemplary responses, outwits the ogre or the yakker. So he's always the violent bad guy in the plot. Yeah. In the old Charlie Chaplin movies, that big guy with the moustache, skulking with the dark eyebrows. Yeah, that's him. So anyway, back to the sutta, the simpler, more elegant sutta. Angulimala sees the Buddha. Isn't it amazing? Isn't it astounding? Groups of 10, 20, 30, and 40 men have gone along this road, and even they have fallen into my hands. And yet now, this contemplative comes attacking, as it were, alone and without a companion. Why don't I kill him? In the commentary, no one's going near the forest. He's got one finger left to collect, and no one's come near the forest. His father knows who's in the forest doing the killing and disowns him. He's out of the family. That's no behaviour for his family to do. The mother, being a mother, wants to go and help. And she's going into this is very Indian. The mother gets involved. Yeah, very Indian story. And she heads into the forest. And Angulimala decides, she's the only one I've seen for a while. One more finger, it has to be her. Mm. Of course, that's the worst thing, to kill your mother. Yeah, it's the worst thing to do. And the Buddha turns up to solve it. So, violence personified is about to meet the Buddha. The ultimate in violence is about to meet the ultimate in non-violence. This theme of meeting face to face is very important. I've been reflecting on this. Buddhism is made up of people. Yeah, it's not an abstract quantity. You can't keep a bag of wisdom under the stairs in a cupboard. There's no insight files that you can download from buddha.com. There's no wisdom. There's only wise people. The Dharma is communication between actual people. This phrase, the spoken word. The Dharma is what happens when a greater perspective meets a lesser one, and when this greater perspective is shared. So the Dharma is something that happens between actual people. Like music is something that happens with musicians. So this is a meeting. This is an unusual meeting. The Buddha is walking calmly through the forest at that same steady pace. And Angulimala spots him and thinks, oh, fingers, or a finger. He only gets the one in each body and starts running after him. But isn't it amazing? Isn't it astounding? In the past, I've chased and seized even a swift-running elephant, a swift-running horse, a swift-running chariot, a swift-running deer. But now, even though I'm running with all my might, I can't catch up with this contemplative, walking at a normal pace. So he stopped and called out to the Blessed One, "Stop, contemplative, stop!" "I have stopped, Angulimala. You stop." This causes him to think. These Shakyan contemplatives are speakers of the truth, and yet this one, even while walking, says, "I have stopped, Angulimala. You stopped." Why don't I question him? All this murder hasn't dulled his brain power. So he addresses a verse to the Buddha. "While walking, contemplative, you say, I have stopped. But when you have stopped, you say, I haven't. I ask you the meaning of this. How have you stopped? How haven't I?" "I have stopped, Angulimala, once and for all, having cast off violence towards all living beings. You, though, are unrestrained towards beings. That's how I've stopped, and you haven't." At long last, a greatly revered great seer for my sake has come to the great forest. Having heard your verse in line with the Dhamma, I will go about having abandoned evil. So one stopped and the other hasn't. This bit is the pivot of the story. Yeah. And I think it's one of the pivots of the entire Pali Canon. It's one of the high points, one of the focal points. One has stopped, one hasn't. One can't catch the other. And it's marked in the text, in the sutta, by them breaking into verse. Yeah? Actually, it's an Indian story, so they've broken into song. It's like in a movie. Yeah, you highlight a musical by the singing starting. Yeah, whether it's Oliver Twist or whether it's an Indian movie, you know, they start singing and dancing. You can imagine that they break into song when it gets more important. Yeah, in the Pali Canon, always verse is when you pay more attention. Yeah. And it's the bit that defies the laws of physics. Yeah. One person's running very strong, somebody can kill 40 people at a go, somebody can clear out entire towns, can't catch this quiet, steadily walking Buddha. In Bhikkhu Bodhi's anthology of the Pali Canon, called In the Buddha's Words, he talks about the Pali Canon switching between two narrative styles. On the one hand, you have a realistic, natural narrative. The Buddha walks along the road. He has his breakfast. He speaks to so and so. You're in our idea of reality, of normal time and space. And another one, a mythical symbolic. And the Pali Canon moves between the two. It uses both styles, both different levels to communicate, and uses appropriately. But if you read the texts, they're not separated. There's not little lights go on. We're now moving into mythical time. It's all woven seamlessly together. The mythical events in these stories appear as part of the natural world. They're woven seamlessly, just as they're woven seamlessly in our lives. If you look over your own life, your own experience of life, they're woven together. It contains natural, realistic elements. It contains experiences you can explain through that. And it contains experiences you can explain through mythical, symbolic. And you don't distinguish. They're woven closely together. And it's important in these stories not to try to limit truth to our narrow modern notions of facts. Yeah. Factual details can't bear the full significance of important matters. Might be useful for plumbing, or is it Higgs boson particles? At that level. When it comes to Buddhism, when it comes to the Dharma, factual details can't bear the full significance, such as being evoked, such as they're trying to communicate, the composers of this story are trying to communicate through the tale. And it's a shame to reduce these stories down to just factual. We lose something of them. Translations are getting better. If you look at the older ones, you get whole chunks where with the scholarly equivalent of mumbo jumbo. We'll leave out this bit because it's just nonsense or it's just archaic, and you're left with very bare factual matters. So the story has a fullness when it has the impossibilities, the magical parts woven in through it. In our life too, we lose something from the stories if we reduce it. We lose something of our life if we reduce it to facts. So here's the Buddha, here's Angulimala, here's two speeds, two orders of reality. I was thinking a handy little way of understanding it is quantity and quality. Yeah. This came about, just triggered by the fact he has 1,000 fingers to collect. That's quantity. Yeah. More and more of the same. The more fingers he gets, the more he'll please his teacher. But the Buddha is of a different quality, an entirely different approach. The Buddha's reality and Angulimala's reality won't ever meet. Or will they? Let's see. So what sense of the Buddha do we get from this encounter? Who do we see here? So you all have your own. You can bring up in the study groups. So here's a couple of mine. First, the ungraspable Buddha. Angulimala's way of living will never catch the Buddha's way. Violence will never meet non-violence. Ignorance never catches up with wisdom. The Buddha's uncatchable. He's utterly other to Angulimala. He's unreachable by his grasping, by his weapons, by his finger necklace collection. And of course, the point of the story is it's reflecting us. It's reflecting who we are. When we read these stories, we're meant to identify with the one that makes the mistake. In English language, it's the fall guy. You have the comedian who's clever and the one that's stupid, and they bounce off each other. This is a point of Vedanya, I think, made in an earlier talk, in a previous event. We like to identify with the Buddha, and we feel ourselves superior, and we're criticising the person that's got it wrong. But our point, the whole point of the text, is that we should identify with the one making a mistake, which helps us recognise our errors, we see it reflected, and then we can mend our ways. So the Buddha can't be understood by our current terms, by the way we currently think. He's not explainable by our current personal experience. He's not containable in scientific, in psychological, or in religious terms. He's not even containable in Buddhist terms, which is a very important point of Buddhism. It points beyond itself. Here's a poem I'm borrowing from R.S. Thomas, who's talking about God, but I'm using this, borrowing it from the Christian tradition. I modernise the anachronism of my language, but he is no more here than before. Genes and molecules have no more power to call him up than the incense of the Hebrews at their altars. My equations fail as my words do. In the Dhammapada, verse 180, that enlightened one in whom there is not that ensnaring, entangling craving to lead anywhere, and whose sphere is endless, by what track will you lead him, the trackless one? So we can't collect him and add him to our garland of fingers, whatever our garland is, whatever it is that we collect. Are we meditating? Are we practicing for an intense experience? Do we collect intense experiences like those TV programs and magazines on 100 things to do before we die? It's like a mad, desperate grab of trying to get intense experiences before it's over. Knowledge, do we collect that? Do we collect information? Do we collect personal development, self-esteem? Enlightenment can't be caught and added on. It can't be added as another item in the current way we understand things. It can't be added as an accessory to our current way of living. It can't be placed as a statue on a shelf in an otherwise ordinary room. It's not reached by a shift of quantity. The Buddha's happiness isn't simply a big version of our happiness. His insight is not simply a deeper version of our insight. His compassion isn't merely our kindness times 10 or times 1,000 or to the power of 10. The Buddha's of a different quality. Angulimala, in this point, in this story, is embodying the central reason for the spiritual life, because it's a central problem of the spiritual life. And it's the problem of life itself. It's grasping. The tendency we have to reduce other people to their utility for us. Reducing people down to a dead, possessable little finger. Yeah? A token, a trophy. Reducing our experience, beauty, culture, teachings, the Dharma itself to utility and acquisition to mine. And Angulimala is skulking in the forest. Yeah. And he is our grasping self. He's us. So the second point I've noticed is the engaging Buddha. All this trying to speak clearly has my mouth drying out. So Angulimala meets the Buddha, and the Buddha meets an enlightened man face to face. It's not a symmetrical meeting. Angulimala can't see the Buddha, but the Buddha sees Angulimala very well. Yeah, there's this asymmetry. The Buddha might be totally other to Angulimala's way of going about things, but he's not distant, because he's walked right to him. He's walked past all the warnings, he's walked into the wood, and he's gone right up to Angulimala. The quality of the Buddha's awakening is not a passive, other-world realisation. Quite different from this contemporary style that's very popular of talking about insight, about just letting go, or a non-judgmental accepting, or it's all just as it is. And these people that set up meditation courses, and it is as it is. It's like a Popeye meditation. Non-dual consciousness is another language where any difference between happiness and suffering, good and evil, is just an illusion. There's a more popular level, street level, which is whatever. Is there equivalent in the German language? You have teenagers, maybe it's passing now in Britain, but an attitude of kind of blank, complacent indifference and whatever. You know. The Buddha is enlightened and you are not. Whatever. There's a lot around these days. There's a lot for sale in this style. But it's not the Buddha's teachings. It's not his way. So here's the Buddha, a fully and perfect awakened human being, treading a path through a jungle. He's walking towards someone in trouble, someone in whom he sees potential. He's coming for him. He's out to make a difference. And Gulimala responds, "At long last, a greatly revered great seer, for my sake, has come to the great forest." This is Tanisaro's translation. It's different from Norman's one, but "for my sake." Yeah. One person is engaging with another, is meeting another face to face. And Gulimala meets a spiritual friend, a Kalyana Mitra, and it changes his life. He meets the Buddha not out of affinity, not out of an initial agreement. He meets him, I'm not sure the geometry, 180 degrees or 90 degrees, completely the opposite direction. Yeah. Which, we need to know that this is where we're all coming from. I agree with the Buddha for this, for this, for this, for this. But by reflecting on the Gulimala story, we realise how much of our approach is like this. Yeah. Violence meets non-violence. The grasping meets the ungraspable. This is the Buddha's actual engagement, his going out, his leaving his content state, sitting under the tree, connecting with others, his actual engagement, all the ones he had, all the many stories, passes down all these centuries to today. It comes down to us here in the shrine room, the effect of it, the big wave of it. Yeah? The stories, the suttas, these icons, our Buddhist centres, our classes, retreats. Comes through these, it comes through a more or less harmonious order which has been established, is maintained for the benefit of all. It comes through the actual practicing Buddhists that we come face to face with. I was thinking recently of Susidi, who's been living in Sheffield for a number of years, but I turned up in 1983 in January to the Glasgow Buddhist Centre and it smelt of lovely fresh paint and incense, which I always associate with Buddhism. Fresh paint, gloss paint and incense. And I've missed it a couple of years where they worked and put all their money into building the centre. And there was a point where it was taking so long to happen and they were running out of funds that Susidi just took his life savings that he'd inherited from his parents and put it in and got the job done. And so I turn up and go, "Buddhism's lovely." You know? Somebody's life work has gone into doing this. Yeah. So it's these encounters that turn our lives around, that centre that turned my life around, meeting Susidi and others. For our sake, the Dharma has been made available. Yeah. The Sangha has been made available. The Buddha has been made available. For each of our sakes, individually. This is not an egotistic thing. It's not, was it Zaphod Beeblebrox? It's not like Buddhism is all about me, but Buddhism never adds up to more than one from a particular perspective. One person making an engagement as an individual, that's it. There's just lots more of those. So you meeting this wave of, for my sake, of the Buddhist tradition, all these teachings, encountering the Buddha, encountering the Dharma, makes you shift. And that's it. It adds up more and more of just these one moments. If it's not working for you, sitting, imagining, being present with the Buddha, if your imagination isn't of that sort, in moments when that's not my sort, when it doesn't work for me, I always think of much more practical. You know, the Buddha's influence isn't some mystical glowing light above my head necessarily. It's the actual effect. This room is here. This centre's here because of him. Yeah. It's much more practical. At long last, a greatly revered great seer for my sake has come to the great forest. Having heard your verse in line with the Dhamma, I will go about having abandoned evil. So Angulimala is converted right there and then. Converted, turned around. Yeah, this angle problem, of whatever it is, he's been realigned by meeting the Buddha. He takes his weapons, he hurls them into a pit, off a chasm. He pays homage to the feet of the Buddha and requests ordination. He says, I want to be doing what you're doing. And the Buddha says, come, Bhikkhu. That's him. That's his ordination. That's him in the Buddha's order. That's him, a follower of the Buddha, a fellow wanderer. And the Buddha sets off. He wanders by stages back to Savatthi. And the now venerable Angulimala is his attendant monk. Tame and quiet. Reminds me of, I grew up on a farm with beef cattle, and we had to tame big bullocks. You had half a ton of beef, and you had to tame it so it would walk calmly in a show with public crowds and lots of noise and disturbance. And then you take 2-3 weeks to turn this thing from, I can think it froths at the mouth with its eyes rolling up in its head and it's going and you, by subterfuge and cunning and persuasion and a little bit of violence, you end up with something following you along, and you know you're doing a job really well when the ropes slack, yeah, and it's going, it's your friend. Think of Angulimala like this, this big guy, you know, he's had his, all his hair cut off, the necklace is gone, of course, because don't wear fingers, and he's just walking quite quietly along beside the Buddha. They set up in Jetta Grove, one of the places where the Buddha's followers lived, outside the great city of Savatthi. And he's joining many other bhikkhus. Just the religious life, the Buddhist life, lived in the grove under the trees. Meanwhile, though, the story continues, a large and noisy crowd gathers at the gates of King Pasenadi's palace. The king is supposed to keep the order. Someone's been going about devastating, killing people, devastating villages, devastating towns, and the populace are unhappy. They're angry. It reminds me, remember the old Frankenstein movies? There always comes a bit where the villagers get the pitchforks and the farming utensils, and they get the big torches and they're marching up the hill to Frankenstein. Well, they're all outside the king's palace saying, do something. They're saying, there is a bandit in your realm, sire, named Angulimala, brutal, bloody-handed, devoted to killing and slaying, showing no mercy to living beings. He has turned villages, non-villages, towns into non-towns, and so on. He wears a garland made of fingers. The king must stamp him out. This is Tanisaro's translation. He's American, so stamp him out. Take him out, maybe. King Pasenadi of Kosala heads out. Okay, he just, okay, I'll do something. Gets 100 horsemen. Yeah, this is, he means business. 100 of his best warriors on their horses. He, of course, has the chariot, the sign of royalty and privilege. The two wheels, horses in front, the finest horses. And they're set off, probably trumpets. And all the townspeople go, ah, good, it's going to be sorted. He travels 10 or 20 minutes and goes to visit the Buddha. Jetta Grove is just outside the town. Now, does he not want to meet Angulimala? Or does he need some spiritual support and inspiration? But he goes, he gets down from his chariot, just as Vidanya described. He approaches on foot. On arrival, having bowed down, he sat to one side. And the Buddha's looking. 500 horsemen, clanking armour, all off their horses, you know, trying to be very subdued with their rough ways and their weaponry. What is it, great king? Has King Bimbisara of Magadha provoked you? Or have Lichavis of Vishali or some other hostile king? Is this a war? Is this an all-out war? The great kingdoms, the Lichavi Republic over to the west, to the south, the great kingdom of Magadha, which would eventually beat his kingdom, Are they coming to get you? Have they annoyed you? Have they insulted you? What's happening? No, Lord, there is a bandit in my realm named Angulimala. I am going to stamp him out. Great king, suppose you were to see Angulimala with his hair and beard shaved off, wearing the ochre robe, having gone forth from the home life into homelessness, refraining from killing living beings, refraining from taking what is not given, refraining from telling lies, living the holy life on one meal a day, virtuous and a fine character, what would you do to him? We would bow down to him, Lord, or rise up to greet him, or offer him a seat, or offer him robes, alms food, lodgings, medicinal requisites, or we would arrange lawful protection. But how could there be such virtue and restraint in an unvirtuous, evil character? The king just, that's impossible. Someone that can do what he's been doing can't change. So the Blessed One, pointing with his right arm, said to King Pasenadi of Koshala, that great king is Angulimala. Of course, the king's terrified. His hair stands on end. And the Buddha reassures him, don't be afraid, great king, don't be afraid. He poses no danger to you. That calms the king down, and he goes over and speaks to him. Are you really Angulimala, Lord? What's your father's name? What's your mother's name? And he calls him by his respectful family name, not by the stigma of finger collector or finger necklace. He offers him whatever he needs, the robes, the shelter, the medicinal prerequisites, all these things. He accepts and respects him in terms of his new life. He doesn't drag him back and chained to be punished. I was thinking a modern politician would be in real trouble. A mass murderer, and he goes and finds him living here, and he goes back and tells him, it's okay, he's a Buddhist now. He wouldn't do too well in the next election. Which is interesting, isn't it? The mood here is of lightness, a release of tension, a freeing. The tension of the violence, of the retribution, of the punishment, that knot has been released. What about the revenge? What about justice? What about guilt? Reminds me of the bit with Shantideva in the Bodhicharya Avatara, where he just wishes, he wants to dedicate all his positivity, that all hells, all torments be emptied right now. If you think in world history, if you think of people, there must be some really rough characters in there. Mass murderers, torturers, child abusers. But Shantideva is saying, may all be released. May all the torment of all beings cease. May all be free, well and happy right now. Not after they've paid their dues. Yeah. This could be another point of discussion in the study group. Moral and legal, ethical matters. The king's impressed. Isn't it amazing, Lord? It's astounding how the Blessed One has tamed the untamed, pacified the unpeaceful. For what we could not tame, even with blunt or bladed weapons, the Blessed One has tamed without weapons. Now, Lord, we must go. Many are our duties, many are our responsibilities. Then do, great king, what you think it is now time to do. The king's a very busy man. He's too much to do to have time to reflect. Yeah. There's deeper implications here, but he's not got the time to spend. He has to go back and dismiss 500 horsemen. Yeah. He's got a lot busy day ahead. And then Angulimala still gets attacked by the angry villagers, townspeople on his alms round. The king was an easy win, but this is different. He's out begging for food, and these people, they're the outer bits of his life. Yeah. The objective, that part of our life, they're his, and they can't be converted quite so easily. It's the result of the residue of his violent behaviour, and it bounces back on him. Just imagine, here comes the man who killed your husband, your father, your child. Ochre robes and a nice peaceful expression isn't going to do it, is it? Isn't going to make it okay. And Angulimala reaps the consequences now, not later. He's giving up. It's like you don't face up to your own unskillfulness. It's like you're shoveling snow ahead of you, which is okay for a while, but the snow pile is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And Gulimala's can decide to go over the top of it. I'm stretching my metaphor. This image of like postponing, shoving ahead the consequences. Yeah. What ceased is the momentum. It is momentum that is heaping up evil consequences. He has stopped. The Buddha said, I have stopped, now you stop, and he has stopped. And what's left is a residue of his past actions, still playing out. He stopped throwing logs and wood in the fire. It's still burning, but it's dying down. What is burning is the result of past logs. There's no more getting thrown on. He comes back to Jetta Grove from his alms round. And he said, clods of earth thrown at him. He said, rocks thrown at him. It's very descriptive. He's had bits of pots thrown at him. It's a text that has been stripped down to the bare, repeating essentials. But they've kept in bits of pots. Yeah? It's not just one thing, but clods of earth, rocks, and bits of pots. Just thrown. And he comes back, his head broken open and dripping with blood, his bowl broken, his outer robe ripped to shreds. And the Buddha encourages him, the Buddha's being a true Kalyana Mitra. Bear it, Brahmana. Bear it, Brahmana. You have experienced here and now the ripening of Kama, whose ripening you might have experienced in hell over many a year, many a century, many a millennium. So his problem is not solved in its own terms. In this story, everybody's needs have not been met. It's still playing out in its own level. Revenge, retaliation. What Angulimala has managed is to have his problem held in a bigger perspective. I was thinking about this, thinking about what to say about this, and Sangharakshita's got a distinction between difficulties and problems. If you have a difficulty, you resolve it by working directly on it. You put more effort in the right direction, and it's no longer there. A problem is not fixable on its own terms. It's as if the terms themselves that you're using to address the problem is the problem. Problems resolve on a deeper level or on a higher level, depending on your metaphor. Some of us like to go up, some of us like to go down. But whatever way you go, it's only resolved on another level by shifting the terms, by shifting the very approach we take. This was brought out yesterday by Saraha's Magandhya Sutta. The Buddha describes the body as a calamity. Yeah, this is the deeper Buddhist perspective. The one which we go, this is a bit difficult, I'm reacting, oh, I've had enough. And it was a Susiddhi again who once said to me, I went, oh, they've actually asked me to go to Guhyaloka and be ordained, help. And he said, it's like being the young soldier being marched to the front with the gun and saying, but I only joined to play in the band. You're being marched to the front. Yeah. With a bit of Buddhism, you go, oh, yeah, the body itself is a calamity. Life itself is a problem. Our bodies, our relationships, our work, an ongoing calamity. Politics. Pramudita was mentioning my interest in politics. It's my equivalent of his football. Every time an election comes on, I get, of course, you've got to support a team to enjoy it. You know? I watch what's happening. I've just watched the Scottish elections with a big landslide for my team, and realising that winning is just the start of the problem. Yeah, these politicians who struggle so hard, yeah. Angela Merkel, Claudia Roth with, was it a local state election? Big green win. David Cameron, Alex Salmond, such effort and focus and skills going into winning. And then the struggle just continues, staying in power. Yeah, the press is still throwing mud at you. The opposition still being as nasty as possible. TV still in Britain, you have Jeremy Paxman just kind of giving a really hard time. It just goes on and on and on. It's a struggle to win. It's a struggle to stay in power. It's a struggle to lose power. It's never solved. You know, and I was watching this and thinking, who would do that? Who would really want to do it? Who would do it? It reminded me of the phrase, politics is a choice between the disagreeable and the disastrous. And you're making this over and over and over and over again. Running a Buddhist centre is a bit like that, but friendlier, with kinder, nicer people. Society is an ongoing calamity. The environment is an ongoing calamity. All these trees and birds around us. Did anyone see this morning the big fluffy piles of feathers just out past the on that way, just past the dining, the lounge area? Yeah. Something's had a lunch or early breakfast, either a midnight snack or a very early breakfast. Something has eaten a big, I think it looks like a wood pigeon. There's a wood pigeon no more, and a fatter fox or whatever's had it. It's an ongoing calamity. We need to do what we can with all these things. We need to carry out our responsibilities. It's not a matter of being back to the passive, what an idea of insight. Yeah. We need to engage. But it's never entirely fixed, never sorted. There's no happy endings because, in Buddhism, there's no endings. An endless calamity, a slow-motion car crash, repeating over, over, and over. This is why we study the wheel of life over and over and over. A wheel doesn't have a start and an end. It's the endless round, samsara. Unfixable on its own terms. The rich complain from the place of the rich. The poor weep from the place of the poor. Each human mind has its own burden of suffering. There is no happy time in samsara. There's a poem I found yesterday by Gendun Chopel. He was a bit of a maverick monk in Tibet. He felt he was arrested and done bad to by the pre-Chinese government in Tibet. We need a change of heart. We need a deep turning about in our attitude. We need a surrender to a bigger perspective, which is what Angulimala does. Reflecting on the story, Angulimala is rescued by the Buddha. It's a case of other power in the Pali Canon. You all know about self-power, other power. It's a way that Far Eastern Buddhism, Chinese, and particularly Japanese Buddhism looked at practice. You have your own self-reliance, and you have reliance on other, on the Buddha, on the teachers, on something beyond yourself. And some schools in Japanese Buddhism are self-power, the Zen, you know, no reliance on words and letters. And then there's the Jodo Shinshu, other power. Amida, Amitabha, there he is, does it for you. Yeah. It's made popular in our community by Sangharakshita, by Bhante. I think it's in the Bodhisattva Ideal series. And we always, it's a common way of talking about Buddhism in our lot. So Angulimala wasn't able to solve his own problem. The more effort he made, the deeper he was getting into the mess. It was a problem, not a difficulty. You know, the difficulty, if he cut off more fingers, it would sort it out. The problem was it was going deeper and deeper and deeper, the more effort. He needed outside intervention. The Buddha appeared as an example of a bigger perspective. The Buddha turned up with a way, with a practice of ethics, meditation, wisdom, that Angulimala himself could live out and could live from this bigger perspective. And Angulimala just simply surrenders to him. He accepts training. So he's got no problem with self-power. He's got no problem with motivation. He was a star pupil back in the college. He's an exemplary murderer and finger collector. He's totally committed to that. And then along comes the Buddha. He just gets on with what he's been given. Just does it. Irrigators guide the water. Fletchers shape the arrow shaft. Carpenters shape the wood. The wise control themselves. Some tame with a blunt stick, with hooks and with whips, but without blunt or bladed weapons, I was tamed by the one who is such. And he serves the Buddha by getting on with the practice the Buddha gives him. and he describes his very enlightenment, his very own liberation in terms of serving his teacher. This little phrase comes up again and again and again. I think Daniel mentioned it, came out of his text. The teacher has been served by me, the awakened one's bidding done, the guide to becoming uprooted, the heavy load laid down. And then he goes off into the forest. Once he's done his apprenticeship, once he's learnt all he can from the Buddha, been supported by the Buddha, he goes off on his own to practice. And he experiences the bliss of release. This is a happy ending. He experiences the ultimate turning round. He who once lived in negligence and then is negligent no more, he's the one who brightens this world like the moon released from a cloud. Who follows up with wholesome deeds, unwholesome deeds he may have done, he's the one who brightens this world like the moon released from a cloud.